Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. I hope you made it a memorable Veterans Day this week and you took time to thank all the men and women you know that have put their lives on the line for the sake of our freedom. If you haven't done that yet, you can do it today after listening to this show. You're going to hear from a Navy veteran of World War II, 87-year-old Varm Kiramidjan of Fresno, California. Was born here back in 1923 in Fresno, and I think folks will recognize that as an Armenian name. Your father escaped the Armenian genocide, right?
Right. He escaped it with he had quite a few friends there that helped him escape, and he came got on a ship and came to from Constantinople. He came to New York. From New York, he came to Fresno, California, and married my mom's name is Jemima Ajdarian. And he married her and continued on having kids, four of us in our family. Three boys and one girl, which is named Zabel Melkonian now.
And you were the youngest of the boys. You had an older brother. Almost 20 years older than you, who was in the service before you were. Now, was he in before Pearl Harbor happened?
Everything was after Pearl. We all went in. My brother and me went in the service after Pearl Harbor.
Well, let me ask you then, what do you remember about that day, December 7th, 1941? Here you are, an 18-year-old kid in Fresno, California. Did that mean something to you at the time? Do you remember how you heard about it?
Oh, yeah. We had, as those days, we had nothing but radios. And we had a radio in our living room, radio in our kitchen, and that's the first thing we always turned on. And of course, we got up, and we all of a sudden, we had a radio announced that Pearl Harbor is being bombed and the war is on. And I remember distinctly. So first thing I did was call my couple of my buddies we grew up with on Michigan Avenue. And they came over and we had our ears pinned to the radio. And my one buddy, his name was Merwin Hesse, and he was in the National Guard, and he was on a 72-hour pass that weekend. And so we jumped in the car, Bill Rooney and Merwin and me. We jumped in Bill's car, and we started driving down Palm Avenue. We picked Merwin up, and we started driving down Palm Avenue. We were going to go drag to Fulton Mall. And when we got halfway there, already they had the MPs out stopping cars, and they stopped us, and they noticed that Merwin was in uniform. And he asked them questions about what outfit you're in and everything. Says, well, you get your butt back, and you get back to your report, back to your commanding officer immediately. So we just turned a U-turn on Olive Avenue and turned around and came back home. And Merwin took off. The last time I saw him was that day until 3 years later when we got discharged.
Yeah, and a lot happened over the course of those years. When did you end up signing up for the Navy?
My buddy, Melvin Garrison, we were working for 25 cents an hour, picking peaches, picking plums, whatever, during the harvest times. He quit doing that, and he went and joined the labor union, and he was called immediately out to the Fryant Dam, to work on the Fryant Dam on the swing shift. So when he worked there a few days, he kept checking with me, and he says, Varm, he says, you ought to go down and join the union. He says, Fryant Dam, they're hiring guys right and left. to work up there. Finally, after a few months, I went ahead and joined the labor's union. And right away, I was called out to Friant Dam to work for Griffith and Company, was the contractor to build Friant Dam. So I was on the swing shift, same shift that Melvin was on, and we used to change off week from week to on driving up there. Every day, we worked from 4 to midnight, worked on there until we finished the dam. And then from the dam, got acquainted with William Jerkovich. The Jerkovich family all played football at Fresno High School, which I graduated from in 41. And so anyway, his dad hired me and another kid named Dooley Raskovich. The three of us used to go to work on the Friant Madera Canal. That's where we started working, and that was all hard labor, jackhammers and everything else. And we built that Friant Madera Canal until we finished it on the other side of 41.
So anyone listening in Central California, if you've driven up the 41, you've seen the Friant Dam and the water being let out of there. That's passing through what you worked on. Do you, every time you pass by that dam, you look up at that big edifice, do you flash back to those days? Do you have a sense of pride that you had a hand in it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I worked there every block. I was... When I worked at the Friant Dam, I was assigned with the cleanup crew. That's when we sandblasted we call them blocks, the big blocks, cement that was being poured. Well, we would have to sandblast that big blocks, and they'd clean them up, and then the carpenters would come and put the facing on for the face of the dam. Cranes would bring those big dumps of cement, day and night, went on and on. We would get those blocks all ready, clean as a whistle.
So did all that hard work prepare you for the Navy?
Well, I guess it did. I wanted to get in the service, that's for sure. And time was getting short, so we got in the Navy. I went in on March 1st, 1943 is when I joined the Navy.
So you volunteered. You didn't wait for them to draft you?
No. I knew my draft number was up, and I went down and joined the Navy. I did not want to go in the Army. I've always wanted to be a sailor, and that's what I ended up being, a sailor. So I joined the Navy and left Fresno on March the 3rd, 1943. Got shipped to Farragut, Idaho for training. And then we went through that, and then we got assigned to our destroyer. And
you didn't even know what a destroyer was, did you?
No, didn't know what the hell's a destroyer, you know. And so anyway, we found out, and we had our skipper. He was a big guy, Withrow. He was our skipper that put our ship in commission. And the first thing he gave us a speech of all of us guys. You were all young kids then. And he says, I want to remind all you sailors that the Satterlee, a destroyer, we are expendable. And then he stopped right there. He says, and we all looked at him, expendable, what do you mean? So we found out what that meant. The destroyer, you'll take whatever they give you, and before you let anything get to a cruiser or a wagon or aircraft carrier, you would take a torpedo any day before you let that torpedo go into one of those kind of ships.
And you would come to know full well what it meant to be expendable. That was on the destroyer, the Satterlee, the DD-626, a Gleaves-class destroyer in the U.S. Navy during World War II. What's the story behind that name, the Satterlee, and who was one of the famous sailors assigned to that ship as they got going with it right off the bat? What were some of the famous places it was? How about Normandy on D-Day? We're going to hear all those stories from Varm Kiramidjan, 87 years old, a Navy veteran of World War II. We'll be right back with more of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting today with 87-year-old Navy veteran of World War II, Varm Kiramidjan of Fresno, California. He served on the USS Satterlee, a destroyer in World War II. That destroyer had a very unique role on June 6, 1944. We're going to get to that. What about that name of the ship? It was named for Coast Guard Captain Charles Satterlee, who was the captain of a ship that sank in World War I. So that's where the name came from. And Varm, when you were getting ready to get this ship going, that ship was in the headlines, and it was kind of funny. You're getting ready to leave from Seattle. The ship was undergoing more construction. And what was the reason that your ship kept ending up in the newspaper?
Well, the reason that the word got out that Henry Fonda was assigned to our ship. He went through boot camp, and he was assigned to be on the USS Satterlee. Naturally, it was in the papers, in the Seattle papers all over, that Henry Fonda has joined the Navy, and he's assigned to the USS Satterlee. So we got pretty well known over there in Seattle, in that area, before we even got out to do anything. You know,
so the ladies were always coming around looking for Henry Fonda.
They were always walking down the docks there, and which we were tied up alongside of, and they wanted to get a glimpse of Henry Fonda. That's when he was just on his verge of being a movie star, I guess it was. And time went on, and too bad he wasn't able to stay on us. He stayed on us until we went through to San Diego and went down our shakedown cruise in San Diego. And right after our shakedown, we went through the canal and went to North Fork, Virginia. And that's where he was transferred to officers training school. So that's as long as Henry Fonda was on our ship. He went to officers training school. And from there on, I don't know what ship or whatever he did after that.
But while he was on your destroyer, you actually got to know him a little bit because he was sleeping right across from you.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We shot the breeze right along. Oh, yeah. He was same old guy that you'd see dragging along, walking his slow motion. You know, he was good. He was a good man.
He didn't act any different than anybody else on the ship.
No, he never acted any different. In fact, when we were in San Diego having our shakedown, he never went to Hollywood. He stayed with us, and we went on, a whole bunch of us guys went on Liberty in San Diego. He was one of us, and we had good times. We had good times together.
Well, and so from a Hollywood star to some actions on the Satterlee that would certainly stand out in history after you had made a couple trips to Casablanca escorting bigger ships. You end up on a journey toward Europe in 1944. What's going through your mind as the Satterlee is heading up down around the Cape and up across the Atlantic toward Europe? Did you have any idea what you were in store for?
Going back a little ways, while we were waiting for our ship to be completed, they took us on the coast of, I think it was Oregon or Washington. They had a whole string of guns, and they'd have an airplane dragging the target, and we would in all practice with our 20s and 40 millimeters and shoot at the target. And we did so much training, and while we were at the barracks on the shore waiting for the ship to be completed, we'd have classes, everyday classes of pictures of the Luftwaffe, the German airplanes, and to identify them. And same way with Japanese planes, we learned how to identify them and what kind of fighter plane is coming in at you and all that stuff. Yeah, we just train. We did a lot of training. Yeah, I guess it paid off.
Well, and it would have to pay off when June 6th rolled around. But before we talk about that day in particular, you talk about the guns, and in your destroyer was loaded with them, all kinds of firepower, probably more firepower than anything else on that ship, more than the sailors on that ship. But what was your role? I'm sure our listeners would like to know what what your station was when general quarters sounded, where you had to go and what you had to do.
I was trainer. My general quarters training was on gun number two, turret gun number two. I was a trainer on it. That's what trains the turret around back and forth. And then right on the other side of the gun mount is my pointer. He's the one that had access to the barrel of the gun. I would have to match the target, and he'd have to match his barrel onto my crosshairs. And that was in manual training. And I was a trainer. I was put on that and stayed at that particular position all the way through the war. And my regular watch station was starboard K-gun. That was a four-hour watch on our depth charges. When you get that watch, you wear the phones 4 hours straight. Not like the guys up on the 40s, on superstructure on the 40s. They had around 7-8 guys up there, and they'd transfer the phones around. The ears got pretty sore wearing those phones 4 hours every 4-hour shift. So anyway, I was on that. I was appointed to the starboard K-gun right from the word get-go, from when we were in commission, and I was a trainer on gun number two, turret gun number two, as a trainer. And that's where I stayed all the way through the war.
So just to clear it up for everyone listening, when you say you have a four-hour watch on the K-gun with the depth charges, so when you're on that watch, you're just waiting, and if there's a submarine, you have to spring into action? Is that pretty much what it entailed?
That's basically, yeah. But still, if whenever any contact we would get, first thing we'd do, general quarters would go. And I'd leave my station and get onto my general quarters station, and then my relief would be there to take over the K-guns during the general quarters. See, each guy is designed for general quarters, had a designation for his particular job that he was going to have to do during general quarters. So I would have to rush up there and get on my horse and get on my gun turret number 20, number two. We had four of them, number one, number two, number three, and number four on aft.
When that happened, when you heard general quarters sounding and you'd run up to that gun number two, what did that feel like? Was that a sense of excitement, some adrenaline pumping through you? Are you energized? You a little anxious?
Yes, adrenaline flew pretty freely. And oh yeah, you're excited. What's going to happen? What's going on? You know, everything is what's going on, and what are we going to general quarters for?
Did you experience that at all before June 6, 1944?
Yes, on our air raids that we had, Plymouth, England, we had air raids before the invasion. We had air raid around 2, it was around 2:30 in the morning. They dropped so many mines. They mined that whole area, and the word came out, no ships to be moved whatsoever until
the minesweepers could come through.
And there was one minesweeper came right there by a big troop ship and set off a mine that was laid right close to that ship, and that thing shot up about 100-foot geyser up in the air. And boy, they had, that's why they told everybody no ships to be moved until the minesweepers gave the okay to move, and that was it. We did not move any ship until the minesweepers made their big sweeps around.
So when general quarters goes off at 2:30 in the morning and it's pitch black outside, and you see the ammunition lighting up the sky, what are you shooting at from gun number two when you're training that gun to where it needs to be? What are you guys taking aim at?
See, all the 5-inch 38 turrets was operated. We would operate from what the director control would tell us. We call him Stretch. He was a tall, lanky guy. He was in charge of the director control. He'd train out to target, and each one of us on the 5-inch 38, we would train out and match his crossbars. And he'd say, train out 045 or 065 or something like that, and switch to automatic. Then it was all up to him. Then the word would come out. If we're going to do any firing, then all of a sudden the word would come out. All guns stand by, load, and then either rapid fire or no fire or whatever. That's the word that would come through the PA system into our compartment.
So it sounds like you didn't have a whole lot of opportunity to watch and know what at all your gun was hitting. You're just so busy following the orders.
We had to follow orders, and if they wanted us to shift to automatic, we'd drain out and shift to automatic. The pointer and trainer of every gun, of gun mounts, the four, we had real powerful lens that we'd see everything going on out in the top, outside. If he was on target of something, we would be able to see that very clearly because we had powerful lenses that we would be looking through constantly, all the time.
Well, and what that means was you had quite a unique view in the early morning hours of June 6th, 1944. And we are going to talk about that when we come back. Varm Kuramidjian, Navy veteran of World War II, our guest today. He was on the USS Satterlee, a destroyer. And you won't believe what that destroyer was doing on D-Day right off the coast of Normandy. We'll have that story when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to get to the thick of it now with Varm Kuramidjian, 87-year-old, the Navy veteran of World War II. He served on the destroyer, the USS Satterlee, which has a very important distinction when it comes to June 6, 1944. Although you wouldn't know it by reading the little black book, the little journal that Varm kept during the war. For instance, it says 18 May 1944 at Bangor, Ireland today, Dwight Eisenhower is here on the Texas. 19 May 44, leaving Ireland. Scroll down to May 28, 1944. Had an air raid this morning. Plenty of fireworks. Well, here we go for the invasion. Today is the 5th, June 1944. I'll be back to write more later tonight. Well, today is the 6th, and we started shelling at 5:30 a.m. and all day long. Some ships were hit. And then you go to the 7th. You didn't write a whole lot about June 6th, but it sure was a very active day for the Satterlee. You can find more in reading some magazine articles of the time, like where it says that the Satterlee was the first American fighting ship within range of the French coast on D-Day, and later, single-handed, she covered the advance of a Ranger unit on a remote stretch of the beach. Not just any Ranger unit, probably the most famous Ranger unit in the whole story of D-Day, one that, of course, was honored by Ronald Reagan in a famous speech there at Normandy, the Rangers who climbed that sheer cliff and were supported by the Satterlee. Let's hear from you, Varm, what you remember about that day of June 6, 1944. How early were you up that morning?
Practically never went to hit the sack at all. We waited. You know, the weather was a big factor there, and Eisenhower hum-hawed back and forth. They were trying to figure out whether they're going to postpone it. If they postpone it, it'd be another good month or so before they could do this invasion. So he finally decided we're going to go. So when he said we're going to go, naturally, we were all happy about that because of the fact that, you know, your intention, waiting, let's get this thing going, you know. So anyway, when he said we're going, so we took off right away. We were the first ship into the range of Normandy there. The Germans had 588 millimeter guns on this point that protruded clear out, the furthest protrusion out to the ocean. And those five 88s had to be taken out before the invasion force came. And this was their job and our job to try to protect all we could to get them landed. We waited, and soon as they loaded one barge, and the barge would be 50 Rangers on it. It was 50 in each landing barge. And that barge would take off, and it started circling in a big circle out in the ocean. And then they'd load another one off of the troop ship that was back there. And the other barge, they loaded, soon as they loaded five barges up with the Rangers, Colonel Rudder was ahead of that Ranger Battalion, the Army 2nd Ranger Battalion. We call them Suicide Bunch. And anyway, they circled, and then all of a sudden they said, okay, we're going in. And as soon as they said we're going in, we were already in underneath that 100-foot cliffs, sitting there waiting for the word. And as soon as the word came out that they're coming in, they're going to go in and land. Well, the land wasn't much of a land because the cliffs were sheer cliffs all the way right down to the waterfront. And we were there trying not to get grounded. The German 88s, they could not train down at us because they can't train down at us because we were right in the bottom of that cliff.
The angle was too steep for them, but you could shoot up at them.
Yeah, we could shoot. Oh, yeah, yeah. We could shoot up at them. So anyway, as the Rangers came in, we started rapid fire, strafing the top of the cliffs, and the Germans would come out there one at a time, two at a time, and they had these big hand grenades, 18 inches long, where we have those throwing grenades. And they rush up to the edge of the cliff there, and they would just literally drop the hand grenades down at the Rangers landing with their barges. A couple of barges were hit before they even got to the landing. And but soon as they got on the little stretch of land that was right below there, they had these grapnel hooks with these big coils of wire. They'd set these tripod grapnel hooks and they'd shoot them up on the cliff. And then they'd get a hold. Once the grapnel hook would take a hold, the Rangers would, one at a time, they would grab the ropes and start hightailing it up one by one along the cliff there. And
you're watching all this unfold through your long-range sight on the gun?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, could see it all what's going on. And, you know, these Rangers are loaded with their whole backpacks and guns and ammunition that they carried and grenades they carried, because once they get on top, you know, they have to have all that stuff up there. So anyway, anytime, like I say, we rapid fire, just constant rapid fire, and we rapid fired practically all day long, knocking off any Germans that would come up to the edge of the cliff there. They would never get back because we would get them. Constant rapid fire. They'd come out of those cement trenches that they had between each one of those 88 guns. We'd have to mow them down. And once they got up there, the big surprise was that the Germans had moved, pulled the 88s out of the bunkers, the cement bunkers, and moved them back of an apple orchard was back there, because the Air Force bombed that Point de Hoc, they called it. We called it Point de Hoc then. They bombed that with tons and tons of bombs. So when the Rangers got up there, the bunkers were empty. They fought their way to the end of the apple orchard and found, by following the tracks, They found the five 88s there. And what they did, the Rangers did, they have these here canisters that they light, and they drop them in the breech blocks of each one of those 88s, and it would melt. That gun is out of order. They no more, they could never use that gun anymore. And out of that 250 Rangers that landed on Point de Hoc, we got word that 90 Rangers went on to fight the war. The rest of them were all killed or casualties. Yeah, 90 Rangers went on to fight the rest of the war. We expended all of our magazines. We had no more shells left. We went across the channel. We were the first ship to leave the channel, went back to Plymouth, England, and when we got there, the docks were just loaded with pallets of ammunition. Everybody on the ship, we had a work detail. We loaded all of our magazines back up, and we got there a little after 6 o'clock that evening, and that's when we worked a whole way through. And we went back the next morning. We went back to Normandy. And when we got back there, there was a destroyer, USS Meredith. It was a brand spanking new 2250 class destroyer was sunk right there at the beach. All was sticking out of the water was its forward top side. It was sunk.
And here you had gone dawn to dusk, nonstop shelling at the very start of the invasion of Europe, and come out of that virtually unscathed. And I guess you probably looked at the Meredith and said, that could have been us.
We never even took small arms fire. We had to get out from underneath the cliff there and turn around and take another position, and that's where we got straddled one time. It had to be mortar shell, and never got hit, never took a small arm fire whatsoever, and the ship never got hit not one time.
Did you ever think, while you were on that number two gun, which is facing forward, looking toward the cliff, that you make a pretty good target if you're on that big 5-inch gun, which is doing a lot of the damage to the Germans, that they would like to take you out?
Oh, yeah, yeah. They had a lot of things to take out on us, but not one hit. We never took a hit. How we did that, Lord knows, I don't know. It's been a mystery to me why we were never even hit with small-arm fire. Because, see, the Germans had machine gun nests stationed up there on top side, and we had to take those out immediately. And anytime there was a Spitfire out on coming from the shore, the R-20s and 40s would be on them right off the bat. Take them out.
I have to imagine that was probably one of the longest days of your life. When I read an article that says the longest break in the shelling was 20 minutes to eat K rations, and you guys fired every ounce of ammunition you had before heading back to England. What was that like to just have nonstop war, nonstop battle from the start of the day to the end of the day?
We took in a lot of smoke in those 5-inch 38s turrets, because every time we fire rapid fire, the whole thing would be full of smoke. Of course, everybody's yakking and coughing and everything. We have guys, we call him the hot shell man. He would try to catch every one of those hot shells and throw them down the cubbyhole onto the main deck. Of course, when the end of that day, the whole top of the forecastle decks was just covered with empty shell casings.
Nowhere to walk, huh?
Nowhere to go, yeah. They wore asbestos gloves clear up to their shoulders so they wouldn't get burnt with those shells coming out.
Well, yeah, and I guess maybe some folks don't know how big a shell is on a 5-inch gun like that, but we're not talking about something you click out of a rifle. This is something that you got to be pretty strong just to carry when it's an active shell.
It's about 2.5-3 feet long, yeah.
Now, I know we have the rest of the war to cover, and we're short on time, but I want to ask you some more about June 6th. When you were staring through that sight, which gave you a closer view of what was going on than a lot of the guys on the ship with you, you saw those Rangers struggling up that sheer cliff face, what you call the suicide mission, and what the numbers show certainly was for a lot of them. Was there one thing that you saw that was really powerful something that still maybe has some symbolic value today when you think back on what you witnessed on that day?
Those guys, how many hours of training they had before this here invasion, and you got to take your hat off for them Rangers, for taking on it's all volunteer, practically all volunteer, and you wonder, well, what kind of guys are these guys? They didn't give a darn. Well, practically none of us knew or cared at those days. We had a purpose. We had a project we had to do, and we did to the best of our knowledge.
Did that inspire you to see what was clearly a very brave action by these men?
Definitely. Definitely. You have to be pretty darn brave to do what those Rangers did. Yeah. You betcha. They're getting fired on. Not only getting fired on, we're firing over their heads. Constant firing over their heads ahead of them, taking care of our business that we had to do.
Well, and clearly that was a pivotal day, if not the pivotal day in the entire war, as the Allied invasion of Europe began that day. That action by the Rangers climbing to the top of that cliff and taking out the German position was crucial to the victory, and I think has symbolic value in the greater fight. Did you have an idea on that day that it would become as big a deal and be such a monumental moment all these years later?
Never crossed our minds. Did not realize what it meant to do this job. We just figured, well, that's what we're here for. We trained many hours doing what we had to do. I guess that's what paid off.
Did you have any idea how many ships were behind you and how big this force was heading toward Europe?
Well, we had an idea, but it was just whole ocean is just covered with ships. So there'll never be another one like that. Never. That was the biggest armada of ships that was put together for that invasion ever. And there'll never be another one, because now missiles are shot 60 miles away and hits targets. So they won't need any armada like that again.
Well, that's clearly a perspective on D-Day that not too many can share. Go to kmjnow.com for more on the Satterlee and its role on June 6, 1944. Also, pictures of Varm from throughout the war. We're not done yet. When we come back, what Varm encountered in the invasion of southern France and one of his most memorable moments in uniform, what it had to do with college football's best. We'll get those stories when Hometown Heroes continues next on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Now, more Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue with 87-year-old Varm Kuramidjan. And you know, as someone who announces college football for a living, I'm looking forward to Fresno State, Nevada tonight. You had a chance, Varm, in uniform to see the number one team in the nation battle number two, long before the BCS. This was Navy trying to dethrone number one Army with its legendary tandem of Doc Blanchard, Mr. Inside, and Glenn Davis, Mr. Outside. It's December of 1944. Supposedly, the only way to buy tickets for that game was to purchase war bonds, but I guess you found a different way. How'd that all happen?
We were called out of the Atlantic, out of clear blue sky, and they said, you're going to escort the cadets up the Chesapeake Bay for the Army-Navy football game in Baltimore, Maryland. And we said, what? And they pulled us out of there, and we always congregated down in the office. I was a storekeeper. Martin was my second-class storekeeper. I was under him. He comes running down the office there, and he says, there's a cabbie out there with four tickets to the football game. We can go to the football game. So we all scrambled for our wallets and everything, and we changed into our blues immediately, and the cabbie was waiting up there on the dock right in front of the gang plant. And the first place we went, we each bought fifth of whiskeys, each of us, and we went to the football game. We were the only ones off the Satterlee that was able to get tickets. We had a ball up there. Everybody's ordering Cokes, and we said, hey, you need a little spice in there? And we'd hand them a fifth of whiskey, and they'd pass it on down the aisle in front of us and back of us and on the side of us and everything. So we had one big family over there, I tell you. We had, what a time we had.
So that was one of your most memorable missions of the war.
That was really a memorable mission, I'll tell you. We had a ball.
Let's go back now. Before your ship would participate in the invasion of southern France, you got to have what was a very special moment for you. You knew that your brother, much older than you, had been serving in Oran in North Africa, and you got ashore there, and you go to a phone booth to try to track him down, and what happened?
Well, what happened, he had already got the word that the Satterlee DD-626 was in the bay. We had to anchor out at that time, and they come flying over the dirt road over the hill, and they had already gave my brother Ludwig the word that your brother's in. He's in the bay, and he's looking for you. That's where we met after a year and a half, 2 years.
What did that mean to you? After everything you'd been through at Normandy and on the Satterlee, to be able to meet up with your brother and share stories and just spend some time together.
My brother is... He was something else. The two of us are very close, and we got much closer after this ordeal. Me and my sister always thought a lot of Ludwig. He was our sole provider during the Depression years anyway, and he worked very hard. He meant a lot to me, and he proved it. He was a type that would invent stuff, always thinking of this and that, always something to he would... accomplish. When they got to Oran, Africa, they were in dire need of a hospital. They didn't have lighting. Well, he cut out squares of wood for a foundation, and he would make the sockets out of copper wire that you screw the
light bulb into.
And he furnished the whole hospital full of these here. General Patton was going through the invasion over there in the desert, and there was so many of the army guys that were having eye problems with shrapnel wounds. Well, my brother, out of the clear blue sky, he invented this here magnet, and he made this out of his own knowledge of electricity and everything. When he flipped that switch, it would pull the shrapnel out of the wounded soldier's eyes through the hole it went in. See, at that time, there was not that many doctors that would do eye surgery, and they were flooded with them guys coming out of the desert. And he invented that. He was awarded the Legion of Merit Medal. They had a big parade in France. They flew him over there and awarded him the Legion of Merit that he got for that purpose.
As far as your own service, after meeting up with him, you still had the invasion of southern France. That probably wasn't much fun because you had German torpedo boats coming at you in the middle of the night?
Yes. At midnight, the Satterlee, we were the only destroyer patrolling from Toulon, France, Marseille, France, and all the way to Naples, Italy. All of a sudden, radar reports to the bridge. Radar control have contact, surface contact. Naturally, first thing, we went to general quarters. We were being attacked by a German, they called an E-boat. It's something like our PTs. They're faster than our PTs. They're bigger than our PTs, but they only carry two torpedoes, one starboard and one port side. And one torpedo, they could not get off. And they turned around and they made a run on us, and then they turned around and went all the way back out. Then they gave us the orders to shoot guns two and three, shoot star shells. So we started shooting star shells out, and star shells lit that whole Mediterranean Sea wide open. And here they came back at us, and finally Skipper called rapid fire just when they thought that's close enough. Our 40 millimeters made direct hits on their torpedo boat that was coming in. It was a big ball of fire, blew them up. And immediately the skipper got on the speaker and said, "We will not pick up any survivors until daybreak," which is very smart because we had no idea whether, hey, they have a German submarine sitting over there waiting to get a pot shot at us with a torpedo. We let those guys float in the water from midnight to daybreak, and then they lowered the gigs down. We took 11 survivors out of the water. There were six of them very much shot up. On the destroyer, we don't have hospital. Our hospital is our chow hall with tables. Doc had to jump from one German soldier to another, sewed them all up, and kept them alive, and the other five were on the forecastle under guard. And I remember this one kid. Well, we were all kids at that time anyway, but had a big smile on his face. And I said, I said, well, buddy, this is the end of the war for you. And he took my hand, I helped him up, and he's still smiling.
Did that put a different perspective to the war for you, to come face to face with the enemy like that?
Well, we just sloughed it off. They're trying to kill us. Here we are saving them from definite death. A lot of the guys says, turn the 20s on them. But no way. We abided by the Geneva Convention. We treated them royally.
The Satterlee was not done. You guys would participate in escorting the ship that took President Roosevelt to the Yalta Conference with Churchill and Stalin. You would end up back in the Pacific and spend some time around Saipan and Okinawa. And it's Saipan where you were when you heard that it's all over. The war is over. VJ Day, the war in the Pacific has ended just like the war in Europe had ended. What did that mean to you? Was that cause for great celebration there on Saipan?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, gosh. The big tender that we were tied alongside, they passed out ice cream and Coca-Cola and cigars to all of us guys. We celebrated as much as we could.
And I know it's a lot to think about when you look back on your entire time on the Satterlee during the war. If you hadn't survived that, you never would have met your wife. You never would have been a father and a grandfather. You wouldn't be sitting here telling me these stories today. When you look back on all of it, look back at everything you experienced, everything you survived, what are you most proud of? And what do you think is most important for us to remember all these years later?
Just got to take it in stride that, hey, there was a lot of guys gave up their lives for this freedom that we do have. I mean, what else can you say? Yeah, that's what you went there for, and that's what you did, and you're lucky to get back alive, not in a box.
Pure and simple. Makes sense to me. Well, Varm, thank you so much for serving our country, and thank you for taking some time to tell me about it.
You're sure welcome. The memories don't leave your mind. You think of that all the time. Hard to believe it's all over with.
Been a long time, but those memories are still clear. We'll post some pictures on our website at kmjnow.com. And thanks for listening today. Varm Kuramidjian of Fresno, California has been our guest. Join us again next week for another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.